Coming up on Broadway Radio, this week on Broadway, we talk with Broadway star Tony Roberts. We review Hello Dolly with Leroy Reams, Therese Raquin, King Charles III, and the Dramatists Guild Gala, Great Writers Thank Their Lucky Stars. That plus a lot more. Please stay tuned.
I feel free. Now I can look at myself and feel proud. I'm laughing out loud.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, November 9th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good evening, Michael.
Hi.
Hello. With us this evening, we have a Broadway star like we've never had before on Broadway Radio. Tony Roberts is joining us. Tony, Broadway fans know him from so many different plays, starting back in, let's see, 1961, Take Her, She's Mine, all the way through things like Don't Drink the Water, How Now, Dow Jones. I stumbled over that. Promises, Promises. Absurd Person Singular. We're going to have to touch on that. Arsenic and Old Lace, Jerome Robbins Broadway. These are just a few of the many, many things that Tony has graced the Broadway stage in doing. Tony, thank you for joining us on a Monday night. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Now, my first question has to be, given that you've worked with David Merrick and you've worked with Jerome Robbins, who was nicer?
who was feared the worst, you mean?
Notice how I put it. Who was nicer?
Who was nicer? They both could be tremendously nice, as I understand even Donald Trump can be. But they also had their darker sides. And at times when that happened, people fled.
All right. Now, obviously, there was some dark times during the triad of How Now, Dow Jones at the Colonial in Boston, God rest its soul. And George Abbott was coming in and Michael Bennett were coming in. Did you say to yourself, wow, I'm worried that Mr. Abbott won't like me? Hey, this Bennett guy's pretty good. Tell me what you remember from that.
I remember George Abbott telling us that we shouldn't worry about being funny. He said, let the playwright be funny. You are the actor, and you should be interesting. And there was some great pressure relieved from being told that by such a great director as George Abbott, who came in and took over like a captain in a sinking ship. And he was very specific about things. He told you exactly what he wanted you to do. Nowadays, I don't know that anybody really takes that authority upon themselves, or I don't know if actors today would accept it. But he was very clear about the moment you should enter and where you should say the line and who you should look at and how many steps you should take and move on. And for us, it was a lifesaver because the show was foundering and he saved it, so I'm very grateful to him.
I don't expect you to remember this, but I'm going to try anyway, because it's a question I've always had about How Now, Dow Jones, and unfortunately it involves a tragedy, and that's the fact that during the run, towards the end of the run, Robert Kennedy was assassinated just a few weeks before you closed. But there was a lyric in the show about some young Kennedy succeeds you that Chubby Sherman had. And I'm wondering if you remember what happened to that lyric, if it got changed, if the song got dropped. And again, it's not your responsibility. If I were talking to Hiram Sherman, I might get an answer from him. But does that ring a bell at all? Do you recall anything about that?
I remember the exact moment in my dressing room, which I probably haven't thought of in 50 years, 40 years, when we found out that Robert Kennedy had been shot. I do remember that vividly. And I remember Hiram Sherman, who I loved and who was one of the most brilliant people I ever worked with, And I do not remember that that turn of phrase, I'm afraid.
Yeah, okay.
I have a question. We had Betty Buckley on our show not too long ago, and I mentioned in passing the London cast recording of Promises, Promises had just been released on CD not long earlier. And I had been waiting for that album on CD for years. It's such a wonderful album. I'm glad they finally put it out. I was wondering about your memories of doing that show in London.
Well, that was a high point in my life. I was 30 years old, and I was in this huge, wonderful show, which had had all of the kinks worked out of it before it opened in New York with Jerry Orbach. And I had the easy part of it. Charlie Blackwell, a wonderful stage manager who was the stage manager of the show in New York, was the director of the London production, and we were a huge hit over there. It won all kinds of awards, and of course, it's every American actor's dream, I think, to want to play in the West End, and that was a great dream come true for me, and it was for Betty, I'm sure, and everybody who was in the company. It was a wonderful time, and I was very, very fortunate to have that gig.
It's a really terrific album. It really is.
Well, I'm glad you think so. Thank you. Thank you.
So who was nicer, David Merrick, Jerome Rupp, to Betty Buckley?
I forgot I was dealing with the media.
We're not as tough as CNBC.
No. I'm not going to pull a Ben Carson on you. Actually, David Merrick was very quiet and made moves behind the scenes that shocked everybody. You know, he would fire people or try and cut down the cast or bargain with people on the telephone about wanting something changed in the show. And if they didn't want to do it, he would threaten them with, you know, all kinds of things that would make them upset. Like he would say, well, if you don't take that number out of the first act, then I'm firing the director. Or, you know, well, then you can't have any costume changes in the second act. Or whatever it was that he could use to make the show, in his opinion, better. He once told me that he felt like a marriage counselor because he had to get the composer and the lyricist and the book writer to all agree on complimenting each other's work. You know, you know, one guy would write a song, but it wouldn't fit the scene that it was supposed to be in. Or the guy writing the book wouldn't lead the book into the song properly. And so Merrick would have to really twist each of their arms to get them to cooperate with one another. And when he did, he ended up with a hit most of the time.
One of the most delightful things in the book is you're talking about being in Don't Drink the Water, the night that Woody Allen appeared in Don't Drink the Water. Could you tell us about that?
Well, Woody wrote Don't Drink the Water, of course, and we had a long pre-Broadway tour, and two-thirds of the cast got replaced out of town, and David Merrick was firing a lot of people left and right, including the director. And we opened and had a very successful run. And for one night, without any warning or anything, suddenly we looked around on stage. There was a big party scene going on. There must have been 20 people on stage in cocktail attire. And one of them was supposed to be an Arab sheikh's wife in full mufti and long gown. And the person usually playing that part was taller than what we saw that night, because it was Woody Allen himself who had decided, for who knows why, I've known him all these years and never really said, well, what possessed you to go out on the stage as the Arab, as the sheik's wife, or the Arab's wife? The audience never knew it was him because they couldn't tell. But the rest of the cast knew it was him. We were all on stage trying to contain ourselves. But he made an appearance. And then one night at the end of, I think it was Don't Drink the Water, it may have been Play It Again, Sam, a few years later, a friend of his, a very funny comedy writer by the name of Mickey Rose, decided for some reason or other to come out on stage and take a bow with the rest of the cast. He hadn't been in the play. And so, you know, and to stop. But not only that, was he an unfamiliar face. They couldn't see his face because he chose to wear a chicken mask. Don't ask me why, but a rubber mask of a chicken. And he came out and he stood stage center with the rest of us and bowed, and the audience was trying to figure out if they'd missed something. So when did that happen?
So Peter had mentioned that this story, as well as many others, are part of your book, Do You Know Me, which just released on October 6th. And this book spans your 55-year career and 23 Broadway shows, 25 films, 3 television series. And also, this is all available in audiobook, which you've done a number of audiobooks as well. So what prompted you to sit down and put it all on paper?
That's a great question. It got put down on paper over a long period of time. I wrote about a lot of things that had happened to me that I thought were great stories, and I didn't know what to do with them. They sat up in the closet for almost 15 years, and I kept updating them and, you know, trying to figure out how to connect them, how to make a story out of it of some sort. And finally, it was becoming an obsession to finish it, to do something with it. And I did come up with a kind of anecdotal way of describing an actor's career, which is something I learned at the very beginning when some guy said to me in the wings, "You know the 5 stages of an actor's career, don't you, Tony?" And I said, "No, what are they?" And he said, "Well, who's Tony Roberts?" Then it goes, "Get me Tony Roberts." And then it goes, "Get me a Tony Roberts type." And then it goes, "Get me a young Tony Roberts." And then it goes, "Who's Tony Roberts?" So it's sort of, it's a nice arc. I don't know how nice it is, but it's usually pretty typical of most successful careers. And mine certainly was successful. I had no complaints about where I went. But that's what happens. And I thought that was a kind of nice umbrella over a lot of the ups and downs of every career. And I didn't know it, but a friend of mine read it, and he said, "You know, it's like a love letter to your craft." And I wrote that down. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at it right now, a love letter to my craft. But that's what it seems to have evolved to be. And I hope that other actors and people who want to be actors will find some inspiration in it. I was very lucky to have a great teacher at Northwestern by the name of Alvina Krauss, who taught a lot of very, very successful people over decades. And she was truly inspiring and very important in my life and development. So I try to pass on some of the things that she had to say.
It's also very nice that this is also a tribute to your parents as well, and how supportive they were of you when you were starting out.
Well, I was very lucky because I had a lot of opportunity, and you know, it's funny. I just heard Hillary Clinton say she believes everybody can have talent, but not everybody can have opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky because I did come from a family that was involved in the theater. I was born in New York City. I was taken to the theater at an early age, and I had advice from people who mostly at the beginning said, "Don't do it. Don't do it. Do anything else you can. You know, why don't you want to go be a doctor or be a lawyer or be something that, you know, you'll be able to pay the rent when you move on." But that was not going to work with me because I wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it from an early age. So I was lucky, and it takes a lot of perseverance and a lot of luck to make it, because there are so many people trying to get so few jobs.
It's also, when you mentioned about they took you to the theater, it's also interesting to see that your first show was around the world. I mean, most people go to The Sound of Music or My Fair Lady, and there you were at this notorious flop that Cole Porter had written. Do you have any memories of it whatsoever?
Well, my goodness, you just made me think, was that long ago? I could have said Birth of a Nation or something like that. Oh, fellas, give me a break. Around the World in 80 Days, it was 1945, I think, or somewhere in there. I don't know, I was about 6 years old, but... I remember the end of the first act, all right, pretty vividly, because Orson Welles stepped down stage as the leading character and took a shotgun and aimed it at the chandelier hanging over the audience and fired something. And all of a sudden, these hundreds of feathers cascaded down onto the audience, and that was pretty thrilling for a six-year-old. And
sure.
Of course, I got one of them and kept it. But I can't tell you much about that production other than that I kept that feather. That was about it.
I would love to ask you about Sugar. The show was not a huge hit, but years later, I saw you and Robert Morris do The Beauty That Drives Men Mad in a concert at Carnegie Hall, and the audience just went nuts. And I'm wondering if you felt it while you were playing it, did it seem like a crowd pleaser?
Well, it was always a shock, I think, from the very first time they made Bobby and I up as women, I mean, which took about 3 hours, and it did, because they were hair people and makeup people and wardrobe people, and they each had their, you know, 45 minutes with either of us, and when it was over, we didn't recognize ourselves. I look more like my mother than I ever thought that I did. That's probably not that uncommon. But when Bobby and I came out in drag in that number in Sugar for the first time, the audience went wild. And, of course, we ended up tossing our handbags into the audience at the end of every performance. They were, you know, they cost about 89 cents a piece to make. And the producers were willing to lose two of them at each performance. But I think the thing that bothered me the most about it were the earrings. Even worse than the heels were the earrings, which somehow didn't feel natural to me at all.
Well, you also, how tall are you, if I may ask?
I'm 6 feet tall.
I thought so, yeah. So that, but whereas Mr. Morris is quite a bit shorter, isn't he?
Yes, I had to look down at him. Or rather, he had to look up to me. But neither one of us was terribly comfortable in the heels, I have to say.
That's no surprise. I saw it in Toronto, by the way, when Johnny Desmond was in it. Do you remember?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And then I saw it in Boston after so many changes had been made, and it was much slicker. So at least you made it into a certainly serviceable entertainment as time went on.
Well, thank you. It was not an easy road. They kept changing things around, and they didn't care for the train. You know, a lot of the stuff takes place on the train as they're going from Chicago to Miami. Mm. And the set wasn't to Mr. Merrick's liking, so they built another train in another theater in Boston. And we would have to rehearse in this other theater in this one train in the afternoon and then go into the real theater and perform the show in the old train, which wasn't such an easy task because you were trying to learn muscle memory. Where do I go and what do I use to this and that and the other thing? But eventually it all kind of worked out all right. We did run for a while, as
yeah,
I
sure,
recall.
Sure. Well over a year.
Yes, well, that was a big hit in those days because I was in several things that closed in 2 weeks. My first four or five things on Broadway didn't last very long. Mm. Not that it was my fault, of course, but...
One of the shows that lasted 777 performances with this was The Tale of the Allergist's Wife.
Yes.
And you talked about it in the book because it was a show that was performing before and after September 11th tragedy in 2001. And tell us about that time on Broadway and the before and after.
Well, I guess like everybody else who was alive at that moment, it was like nothing that had ever happened before, because nothing like that ever did happen before. So it was disorienting to the extreme. And it was pretty scary there because there was also an anthrax attack going on at the same time, at least a rumor of it. Yeah. And, of course, everybody, all the pundits were saying that this was perhaps the beginning of something that was yet to come and that could be even worse. Mm-hmm. And Times Square was shut down, all the plays, all the shows closed down for about three or four performances.
And I think people were also saying things like, will we ever be able to laugh again? Will we ever be able to go see theater and see a comedy? And but, of course, it turned out to be the opposite.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. They, you know, they even changed part of the script immediately in A Tale of the Allergist Wife. There was a reference to terrorism at some point in the script. And there was a big meeting, and the powers that be decided that that would be unnerving to an audience to hear that word. It might take them out of whatever distraction, you know, the play had put them in. So they changed the dialogue. Eventually, I think months later, they went back to the original dialogue, but initially it was felt that it would be provocative in a negative way, so they didn't use it. But we were going down to Times Square, which was empty, and huddled in our theater, which the audiences, when we came back and started playing again, the audiences were maybe 200 or 300 people, and they had been, you know, 1,200 people. So it was like very bizarre to suddenly go from a packed house and all the festivities of a hit to something that was kind of depressing and maudlin and scary. But gradually, and of course the most startling thing were the audiences that huddled outside in the street after the show in those early days, who were people who didn't live in New York City, but who had come to New York City to support the city. The Mayor Giuliani at that time had asked people to come to New York and support the theater here and the other industries here, and many of them did at their own expense and great inconvenience, and they traveled from great distances, other states far away, and came to see the theater and stood in the street afterwards to thank the actors for performing. It was very moving, and I can't say I was glad to be a part of it, but it was quite a thing to be a part of, certainly.
You mentioned in the book that your parents knew Stephen Sondheim's parents, and that they bragged about his playing the Rhapsody of Blue when he was 14 years old and without a single mistake. Did you bring this up when you did Follies at Paper Mill with Mr. Sondheimer?
Yes, I actually did. and amazingly, he remembered. Or at least he convinced me he remembered, and I think he was being honest. He said, "Yes, I do remember that night." And he said, "I was very fond of your father." I was flattered by that, of course, but I guess the good news is that I wasn't at that party where he played Rhapsody in Blue flawlessly at age 14 or whatever he was, because I would never have touched the piano again if I had heard. That would have been it.
That's so interesting to me. I have not had the pleasure of reading your book yet, but I had no idea that Sondheim was ever that good a pianist.
Well, he sure was better than me, I'll tell you that. I didn't get far in that piece. I could play the first flute solo, and then that was it. It all fell apart after that.
It had to be disappointing that Follies, that was so spectacular, didn't come in. And then the next production of Follies we had here wasn't nearly as good as the one that you were in at Paper Mill. Not nearly.
Well, bless you for saying that, because it was a tremendous disappointment that we didn't come into town with that show, which I think was, I shouldn't say it was the definitive production of it, but it seemed to please most people more than more than all the other productions, I think. And certainly Mr. Sondheim was involved in that, and a lot of wonderful people. Jerry Mitchell, who, of course, has now got yet another hit on Broadway, and a great cast. And I get to stand there and bow with Ann Miller at the end. My God, it was a thrill. And it was a wonderful production. And
it was.
Paid a fortune for the set, because it was their some kind of anniversary of that 50th anniversary of the theater or something. So they brought sets out of warehouses that were, you know, had been stored for years. And it was magnificent. Great cast and great company. And it was very disappointing that we couldn't bring that in.
I don't want to put you on the spot, so feel free not to answer this, but people have always speculated on why it didn't come in. And I know that Ann Miller asked me if I knew why it didn't come in. So well, if you don't know, Miss Miller, I don't. But do you?
She may have been more tactful than I, because I think I did know why it didn't come in. And I think it was because the wife of the librettist
made a deal with Roundabout that they would do that they could do it if they also did The Lion in Winter.
Well, I can't attest to that being the deal, but I knew there was a deal that had been made, and that she held the rights to prevent the Paper Mill production from coming into New York City, and the rights were given to the Roundabout, if that was what it was. I think that's true.
Correct. Yeah.
And they went ahead and did it their way. And it had nothing to do with the production or the sets or anything else that we did. Mm-hmm. And, of course, everybody in our company was hugely disappointed and out of work as well.
Sure.
So, but that's the most I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all of these things here and more stories than one could ever shake a stick at in 300-plus odd pages. Tony, you're going to be doing a book signing and a reading at the Drama Bookshop coming up on December 15th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. So we encourage our listeners to get out there to the Drama Bookshop and listen to some stuff and purchase a few books, and they're great stocking stuffers. And
well, in fact, they are, because the size of the book is ideal for a stocking. Yes, indeed.
Exactly.
Yes. It feels good in the hand.
And don't forget, also, there is an Audible audiobook as well that feels good in the ears as well.
Thank you.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us on a Monday night and telling us about your stories and the book.
It's a pleasure. Anytime, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I've got those God, why don't you love me? Oh, you do, I'll see you later blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters. Feeling that if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough. And thank you for the present, but what's wrong with that stuff? Those don't come any closer, because you know how much I love you.
All right, so we are recording on a Monday night because Peter just returned from Florida, where he saw Hello, Dolly, starring Leroy Reams. Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, let me say that before I went, I watched a video of Danny LaRue playing Dolly Levi in London. It was done sometime in 1995, the video, although he had done it in the West End at the Prince of Wales Theatre sometime before that. In fact, I went to London and I missed it by a week, which is one of the great tragedies of my life. But now that I've seen the video, maybe not. Because Danny LaRue really fooled around with the part quite a bit. At one point during Dancing, you know, that big production number, he said to Cornelius, Fred Astaire had nothing on you. Well, Fred Astaire was born the same year Hello, Dolly takes place, so that doesn't make any sense. And also, he actually, when Barnaby fell down, made a comment about you fell on your ass. That isn't quite it, but the word ass was used. You know, and Dolly Levi would not use the word ass.
No.
Not in 1899. I mean, she's much, yeah. So anyway, but you know, on the other hand, to be fair, I mean, the British sensibility is very different from ours, and people who are female impersonators, that's a tradition there. And so there's a lot of leeway given. So I have to give leeway to Danny LaRue. So here's Leroy Reams, who reportedly is only the second guy to do it and the first in this country. And the wonderful thing about him is that he has so much heart, that he really cares about the people who are on stage and the characters. It's it was so nice at the end of Dancing when the lovers went off together. And the fond look he gave them was just so moving, because it really indicated, you know, I remember when I was young and when I was in love and what a wonderful thing it is. And I am so glad that they are having that experience too. So that's really what is so wonderful about his performance, the heart. So it's kind of funny, of course, you hear lines. His first line that he sings is, "I have always been a woman," you know. Well, you know, but that's not true. He goes "Hi" at the end of "I Put My Hand In," which is really quite nice. Now, I don't mean to say he goes into falsetto. I just mean he hits the note high. He uses his own voice, just as Danny LaRue did, by the way. There's no attempt to sound feminine. I will admit he looks a little like Sophie Tucker, you know, and Leroy is famous for his jet black hair, and now he is wearing a wig that really looked orange to me, so orange is the new black. What can I tell you? You know, I mean, it's pretty. I don't think the costumes flattered him terribly much, and I have to admit that the one that they chose for the famous "Hello, Dolly" number, the red dress, could have passed for what Roger Debris was wearing in the scene where he meets Bialystok and Bloom. I wish the costumes had been rethought, because that would have helped tremendously. But the character is there, and he certainly sings well, and it's just a lot of fun to see it. Some of the sets came from Music Theater of Wichita, but a lot of the sets are not sets at all. They're projections, and I'll bet that's what's going on at the Wick Theater in Boca Raton, and I bet that didn't happen in Music Theater of Wichita, which I bet had sets for every scene. They only shipped a few of them there. The wonderful thing that turned out to be even better than we would have anticipated was Louis Stadlin as Horace Vandergelder. Afterwards, I was talking to him, you know, and he said, and this had never occurred to me, he said, you know, I just wind up playing all these David Burns roles. Because don't forget, David Burns was the original banjo in The Man Who Came to Dinner, and of course he was in that Nathan Lane production. And he said, and that encore's Do Re Mi, David Burns was in Do Re Mi, and I played the same part. And he said, and there's another one too I can't think of. And it wasn't until the next day that I remember what it
Forum.
Was. That was, yeah, exactly. Senex and Forum. You know, that was David Burns, for which he won a Tony Award, in fact. So, but boy, the pinpoint time, you know, I mean, Stadlin's an old pro. His father, Alan Swift, was an actor. In fact, Lewis once told me that when his parents got divorced in 1964, the big tragedy wasn't that he had to go live with his mother as much as the fact that on Wednesdays Variety wasn't there anymore, because his father used to get it every Wednesday. And of course now, so he's a Broadway baby from way back, needless to say. And so his pinpoint timing and his curmudgeonness was really quite wonderful. And of course, when he comes to the Harmonia Gardens and is has his very formal top hat, he almost looked like the guy in the Monopoly on the chance of community chess cards, you know, but his delivery was really quite wonderful. Very, very fine production. Leroy directed as well. Of course, he's directed it before. He's directed with Carol Channing. And may I point out, he did not try to do anything vocally that Carol Channing did. There was now you might say, well, who would want to sing like Carol Channing? And I understand that point of view. No, what I mean is he didn't use her intonations. He didn't deliver lines in the same way that she did. He played it straight. He played it in his own way. He played it sincerely. There's always been a lot of talk about the fact that when Dolly was starting, Gawain Champion said, I think it should be sort of cartoonish. Well, Leroy didn't play it that way. He played it for real emotion, and I think, and the audience accepted him fully. The only problem with the audience at the end is people were yelling bravo, and I think it should have been brava. But but let me say too, I really want to praise James Clough, who may be the best Cornelius I've ever seen.
Wow.
and Susan Powell, quite wonderful as Irene Malloy. So really first class stuff there. So tremendous. Of course, not as many people on stage. The theater has about 300-350 seats, maybe. A nice facility. Very, very pretty. It's called the Wick Theater because it's named after Marilyn Wick, the woman who's running it. And it's been there a while under a different name. This is her third year being there, but she certainly wants to make a go of it. She's also going to be doing South Pacific and Curtains this season. And I hope they turn out as well as this one did, because Dolly isn't just fun, and you really have to get emotionally involved with this woman who wants to rejoin the human race. You really have to care that this happens, and Leroy made us care, so a nice success.
Well, I'm delighted but not surprised to hear that, because when you think about it, Hello, Dolly, it's really not – you couldn't really say that it's a campy show.
No, no, you know? But it is true that Gawa Champion did use the term cartoon when he was directing, you know, and some of it was cartoonish, and certainly Minnie Faye, certainly Ernestina. I mean, you know, Ernestina Whaling. God, why would Ambrose want to marry her? You know, I mean, you know, so there were things that were over the top, no question about it. To be fair, to Gawa Champion, Leroy kept in Ernestina crying like crazy, and Minnie Faye being kind of squeaky. It's not a flaw. I'm just saying those decisions were retained. So, but you know, and it's always good to see, at least for me, Hello, Dolly, which of course was the biggest hit in the history of Broadway when I was growing up. It became the longest-running musical. It will always hold the record for holding the record the shortest period of time of the longest-running musical, because only 9 months after it had superseded My Fair Lady as the longest-running musical, Fiddler superseded it. And and I, you know, so 9 months, and I mean, you know, really, how long will it take for if Phantom closed tomorrow? You know, it would still take 10 years before The Lion King were to overtake Phantom. So, you know, really, I do think Dolly will always remain the shortest, longest running musical of all time.
All right. Next up is Therese Raquin at the Roundabout Theater Company Studio 54. Michael, Peter, and I got a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Therese?
Yes, it's based on a novel by Émile Zola, and originally written in French. And this is an adaptation by Helen Edmondson and directed by Evan Cabinet. I think that's how you say his name, unless it's Cabinet. I don't know. at the Roundabout at Studio 54 with Keira Knightley, Gabriel Ebert, Matt Ryan, and Judith Light in the leads. And it's a story that some people may know as the basis for the musical Thou Shalt Not, you know, as short running as that show was, and actually quite terrible in many ways. It still had quite a bit of notoriety because of the people involved in it, including Harry Connick and Norbert Leo Butz and Susan Stroman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's a really the original story is really quite compelling. It's about a woman in a loveless marriage. She actually winds up marrying her cousin, whom she has known since childhood. The marriage is not based on passion. It's not even based on love, really, so much. It's just based on, I guess, convenience, you would say. And it's a very loveless marriage, and she's tremendously unhappy. And then she winds up having an affair with someone who is an old friend of her husband. But I don't believe that she knew him as a child, did she?
I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And then it's all right. So this is quite an old piece. So I'm about to give some plot. I hope it's not a spoiler that they wind up the couple, the lovers, wind up arranging for the death of the husband. And it's basically what happens is the guilt over this ruins you know any relationship they might have had, which I always. That's something that always has intrigued me. There are many stories, similar stories, on the same theme. And I always wonder, do people think in that situation, do they think that they are so amoral that they will really be able to have, you know, to kill the third person and then have a life together with each other without succumbing to tremendous guilt. I don't know how you could be that amoral to think that you could actually do that. And there are, as I say, many pieces like that. Double Indemnity is one famous one, but there are hundreds, probably hundreds. So I never quite understood if that's – I guess they just think that they're just acting on instinct and that's what they think they should do at the time. And they don't really think, well, you know, so what are then we're going to go live together for the rest of our lives and have a happy marriage. It doesn't seem very realistic. But anyway, these two don't. And it's the story itself is quite compelling, but this is the first time I have seen it on stage. And I felt that it really did not work very well at all. I'm not quite sure how much of it was that was the production and how much was the adaptation and how much was the direction. But one issue is that Therese, played by Keira Knightley, she in the beginning, she doesn't really say much for the first several scenes of the play. And so that's a tremendous challenge for an actress, which I didn't feel she was able to meet. I don't know how she could have. I don't know. I mean, you have to say something for the audience to try to relate to you. But the other thing was that she did you get this, Peter? Because, I mean – She's having this arranged marriage and the mother and the son are arranging the marriage and they don't seem to notice that the expression on Therese's face is as if she's going to be sent to prison for the rest of her life. I mean, I don't know.
I'm looking at my notes right now, and I have here, no one questions her introspection. And so I know exactly what you're talking about here. And that does seem to me to be a flaw in this play or in this production or in, for all I know, the original novel. Yes. But why is it that nobody's smart enough? One of the big bugaboos I always have is when people are lying on stage and they go, and nobody says, right. Oh, you're lying, you know, which is what would happen in real life. Well, this is the other side of that, and that's is she's so moody, she's so quiet. It's not like she ever smiles. Why does anybody say, Therese, something wrong? You know, I mean, it just doesn't happen.
I guess it's supposed to be that they don't they take so little notice of her. But it just didn't seem very realistic. I mean, they're talking about, you know, the idea is brought up that they will get married and she looks like she's about to die. And nobody seems to notice, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, to be fair, it might very well be the whole point of it, that people – that she was so insignificant to both of them that they didn't even give her that much of a thought. They didn't put that much thought in it. I have also a note here, like Maria in West Side Story at the end of the show – she's dead already. There's that famous expression about whether or not there was talk about having Maria kill herself after Tony dies. And somebody, I don't remember who it was, a very famous person said, don't have her do it. She's dead already. I think it might have even been Richard Rodgers. But anyway, this is how this woman seems. And what was funny to me, Michael, you know, was the fact that, as you say, she has so little to say in the first act.
So little.
Ironically enough, and we won't say why, Judith Light, who certainly plays the husband's mother, has very little to say in the second act. I will say no more about that. But Gregory, is that his name? Gregory Ebert? Gabriel Ebert?
Gabriel.
Okay. Who we know from Matilda, who won a Tony Award. This is such a tough character because next to Jonathan in the play Oded, poor dad, mama's hung you in the closet, and I'm feeling so sad. Has there ever been another mama's boy like this kid? I mean, really, you know, that's really a very old world value, being as devoted to his mother and certainly towing the line and expecting that she expects that he'll do everything that she says. And he does, you know what I mean? So, and it's another reason, I think, why Therese doesn't love him, because he's not his own person.
Right.
So out comes this good-looking guy, you know, comes to the house, and boy, it's close to love at first sight if it isn't love at first sight. And yeah, as Michael says, you know, this really does bring up the point. It's much easier to kill than it is to live with it afterwards. And that's what's the fascination of Thérèse Raquin. So melodramatic? Yeah, I'm afraid so. But I thought it was very sit-throughable, and I liked it on a certain superficial level. I've seen thousands worse, you know, that type of thing. That's the best I can do. But I don't think it was atrocious. And yet, the reviews were not as good as, well, let's say, most of the critics didn't like it as, or tolerate it as much as I did.
Well, I also thought the lighting was so dim.
Yeah.
In the first scene, I couldn't see their faces. And I understand, again, I understand the point. Another thing that may have been intentional was I thought that there were two or three sort of sex scenes between Thérèse and Laurent, and I thought they were completely sexless. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that may have been completely intentional, but it didn't work. Mm-hmm. It really did.
You haven't mentioned the enormous lake stream pool that they put upstage.
Well, that was quite wonderful. But another odd thing that I thought was that the set was I think there were some interesting things about the set, but then all of a sudden you have a scene that's supposed to be in a park, I guess. They're in a park where the lake is or something. Yeah. And all of a sudden you have these wooden posts in the back. And I was like, what are they supposed to be? I was trying to figure out if there was some logistical reason for them to be there, but I couldn't figure it out. So I'm clueless.
Yes, while there's a lot of water on stage, it is far away enough from the audience, so you will not have to use your seat as a flotation device. So.
Yeah, I have to wonder why Keira Knightley felt motivated by this script to make her Broadway debut.
It does seem like a very odd choice in that sense, because it's so difficult. I mean, even... as I say, just because for the sheer lack of lines that she has at the beginning. But I do think that maybe it might have been better if she had done things like when she was talking to the mother and the son, if she had not so obviously seemed like she was, you know, hating this whole idea so much, and then maybe in her private moments shown the audience that that's how she was feeling. I think that would have been a better choice, because I don't, it just is like, you're like, what is going on here with this mother and this son? Can they not see that she is in agony? It really didn't work for me at all.
I don't know. I seem like the mother and son were so self-involved.
I'm sure that's the point. Sure. That's the point.
But, anyway, so I guess we should move on to the next show, which is King Charles III, where Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you give us a rundown on that?
Well, at the end of the first act, I thought, well, this is good. You know, solid show. Yeah, fine. But by the end of the second act, I was really bowled over. And, you know, we always see that famous expression, second act trouble. This play doesn't have it at all. It does start off very hauntingly because it's going to be very interesting if this play is running when Queen Elizabeth dies, because it begins with her funeral. And it's going to be an awkward performance if indeed the Queen leaves us during the run of this play here or anywhere else. And this play will get done by other people because it really is very good. But it does start with the funeral. People are seeing Agnus Dei, which is interesting to me because that means Lamb of God. And Agnus of God played that same theater, the Music Box, where this is now. It's in blank verse and you feel it. And I don't mean that as a criticism, but you do feel the blank verse. It's very highly poetic. However, there are times when it is not in blank verse, when people are commoners are speaking, or people are speaking to commoners, which is kind of interesting in its own sense. The country of Wales is used as a punchline. You know, in a way, it's a little Lion in Winter-y in the sense that we're looking at a regal family, and it's just about being a family. You know, that there's a lot of strife between father and there's a lot of strife between father and son. And in the classical tradition, one son is serious, and that's William, and one son is not serious, and that's Harry. We'll see what happens with those two. I'm a little disappointed, and this may be too much to ask. I'm a little disappointed that people don't very much resemble their real life counterparts. Harry, the real Prince Harry, wishes he had the head of hair that this actor does. I'll tell you that right now. But this is the play that Shakespeare didn't write, and couldn't write, of course, because these people weren't around then. But it does have that Shakespearean feel to it. I mean, Shakespeare wrote about Richard. He wrote about one John, two Richards, three Henrys, more than that. Right, because Henry VIII, too. I keep forgetting that one. But anyway, this is the play he would have written if he were around today. It certainly borrows a lot from Shakespeare. You have soliloquies. You have a scene that is very reminiscent of when Hamlet meets his father in Hamlet. You also have a bit of King Lear, not with daughters, but with sons. And in a way, strangely enough, I was also reminded of The Last Emperor, that Oscar-winning movie about Puyi, the last emperor of China, who was really a historical fall guy. And that's part of what this play is saying. I mean, it must be we'll never get into Prince Charles's mind, but how much is he bothered by the fact that certainly by now he expected to be king? I mean, you know, who expected this woman to last this long? This woman's lasted longer than Queen Victoria did. I mean, that was supposed to be an amazing thing. Granted, people live longer now. But still, I think when Charles was growing up, he figured that he would have been king by now and for some substantial period of time. And when he does ascend to the throne in this play, as Mike Bartlett sees it, it may not be easygoing. And one of the things that he has to do is establish himself right off. He really wants to let people know that he is his own man. And perhaps that's a bit of a folly. Maybe he has hubris, as so many Shakespearean characters do. So that comes into play as well. So I didn't see the play going in the direction it went. I'm not saying it wasn't a valid direction. It certainly was. However, it does reiterate that Charles has had a tough time of it. And conceivably, if Queen Elizabeth did die, he might have a tough time of it again. So I hope he doesn't. You know, good luck to him. Though I guess, you know, I'm sure he doesn't need my luck. He's had an easier life than I've had, I'm sure. But this is an arresting play, and I don't know if it's going to do big business because I don't know how much people are interested in the royal family. I don't know how much people are interested in British history, and that comes into play a good deal, too. I don't know how much people want to tolerate blank verse or the fact that we're all saying, everybody's saying, it's like a Shakespeare play. Yeah, I do believe that's why Something Rotten isn't selling out, and I think that may be a reason why, if in the weeks to come King Charles doesn't sell out, is it may be that people are scared that it's going to be much too Shakespearean. No, it's easier to understand than the hard Shakespeare plays, but I hope it does well because I think it really deserves to.
Michael, what did you think?
Well, before I say anything, Peter, I just wanted to did you mean that Harry or William is the one who you said you wish the real person wishes he had that head of hair?
Did I mix it up? Somebody, one of those two kids is bald, right? Or almost bald. Or
yeah, William. That's William. Yeah.
All right, fine. But he has red hair, right?
Harry's the redhead.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. See, this is an example of the type of thing I'm talking about that, again, people may have much more interest in the royal family than I do. But I wouldn't be surprised if people just don't have that much interest in the family, because I really don't. You know, I'm against, you know, royal family. Who are these people? I mean, yeah, we're here in America. We all believe everybody should be the same. So, I mean, yeah, so I have no tolerance for the royal family. So no wonder I got that wrong. Keep talking.
No, it's interesting because I wouldn't say so much that I have not much interest in them, but I really have very little knowledge. But that said, I think that although it is true that Oliver Chris has more hair than William. I thought he was almost spookily resemblant of him. Richard Goulding as Harry, somewhat less so, but he got the voice so well. I thought that he was pretty extraordinary too. And they're all great actors. And Tim Pigott Smith really have to.
Yeah. I didn't mention him. Yet.
No, it's fine. He doesn't look especially like Charles, really. Not much at all. But a magisterial performance. Mm-hmm. And all around, everyone was great. I love it that it's billed as a future history play by Mike Bartlett. Like Peter, there were actually two or three things in the play that I did not see coming. The end of the first act, which I will not divulge, it was really quite stunning. And then what happens, and it's a perfect place to end act one, because it's like this major, major, incredible thing happens. And then you're like, holy shit, what's going to happen next? And so then act two became really, really extremely interesting. Although I did think that William had a turnaround in act two that did not seem motivated to me. That was the only problem I had with the play. And then also one other thing, there's something that towards the end that you find out is happening. And then after that, it seemed a little tiny bit anticlimactic at the very end, just because I was expecting maybe another reversal that didn't happen. But I think it's extremely well written and incredibly well acted. And aside from everything else, Peter mentioned how they sing the Agnus Dei at the beginning. This bunch of actors singing really beautifully this very operatic, piece. I suppose maybe there was track. They were singing to track, and there were also voices on the track, but I think they were singing live also, and it really sounded pretty great to me. So I enjoyed it very much. We should mention, I think it's okay to mention, that Diana does figure in the play as a ghost. And in that case, that was one case where I thought, well, gee, I wish she had looked a little bit more like her. The hairstyle on the actress was nothing like the hairstyle I associate with Diana. So I guess they did it again on purpose, but I'm not sure why they did. But all of that said, it's I'm really glad it's on Broadway, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I love the Shakespearean allusions and the way that the structure was very similar to several Shakespeare plays. Again, that said, as Peter said, I don't think there's anything intimidating about it. It's not hard to understand in the least, and the blank verse aspect is not off-putting in any way. Mm-hmm. And I did very much appreciate the way that it's not all in blank verse, and there are conversational moments that are just prose. So I highly endorse it, and I think everyone should try to get to see it if they can.
And it is a limited run. It's playing through January 31st, 2016. So their website says tonight, on Monday the 9th of November, that there's 96 performances remaining. So try to catch one of those 96. So Michael and Peter, a couple of weeks ago, got to thank their lucky stars, or maybe they were the lucky stars, because they were at the Dramatists Guild Gala. And Michael wanted to tell us about that. What was it like?
Yeah, there's been so much happening lately that we kind of forgot to mention it. But I think it was quite an extraordinary evening held at Gotham Hall, which is a great space on Broadway around 36th Street. And it was the Dramatists Guild Fund Gala called Great Writers Thank Their Lucky Stars. And the gimmick was, yes, the great writers such as Sheldon Harnick, Pasek and Paul, Lawrence O'Keefe and Nell Benjamin, Gretchen Cryer and Ancy Ford, Kristen Chiles and Stephen Schwartz and Stephen Sater all presented, quote unquote, their lucky stars, people who have, been great interpreters of their work. And it started, how's this for, it started off with Danny Burstein doing If I Were a Rich Man from Fiddler, which I think, I suppose, was maybe his first public performance of that, because the show hasn't started previews yet. And then Ben Platt did Waving Through a Window from Dear Evan Hansen, which is by Pasek and Paul. Mo Rocca did a hilarious song called A Modest Proposal by Lawrence O'Keefe and Nell Benjamin. I really love this stuff. Oh, Benjamin Scheuer did his own work, Weathered the Storm from The Lion, which was a big hit for him downtown a few months ago. And then Karen Ziemba, who the night before had given a really incredibly beautiful performance of Once Upon a Time at the Encompass New Opera Guild event honoring Lee Adams. The night on this night, one night later, the 26th, gave an just a definitively beautiful performance of Old Friend from Getting My Act Together and Taking It on the Road by Cryer and Ford. And the other thing that made that just really special was that it had an orchestration for full orchestra. And Nancy Ford, when she got up, said how this was the first time the song had ever been orchestrated. So that was kind of historic and also extremely beautiful. Kristen Childs, we had Felicia Finley, Anne Harada, Rashidra Scott, and Alicia Umphress doing Three Magical Fairies, a song from Funked Up Fairy Tales. And then, sorry about the little siren in the background, but it is Ninth Avenue. Stephen Schwartz introduced Kristen Chenoweth doing For Good from Wicked. And then Stephen Sater introduced a whole bunch of people doing the Song of Purple Summer from Spring Awakening. So it really was a wonderful event. And the thing about the Dramatist Guild, and I guess this is true of many organizations, but they really make a point of how they support young writers. And so that's really a major, major, major thing that they're all about, and I applaud them for that. But to have these great people introducing – these great writers introducing these incredible talents as part of the gala was very, very special. And it – oh, Darren Criss hosted the evening, and I thought he did quite a good job of it. So I had a wonderful time, and I really – I'm glad that I got to be there.
In fact, Darren Criss had the best line of the night when he said, you know, this was going to be, this event was going to be previewed in the New York Times with a full page story, but then someone in Hamilton bought a sweater. So a good indication about the fact that a lot of people have noticed that Hamilton is getting quite a bit of coverage from the New York Times. So that was a good line.
And yeah, Jonathan Tolins wrote the script, we should say, and he had some really good lines that he put in Darren's mouth and other people's mouth, so that I thought he did a really good job with it.
All right, so that's quite a one night only event, a lot of fun sounds like. Peter, a couple of weeks ago, probably 5 or 6 weeks ago now, we talked about, you reminded me that the about when you mentioned Hamilton, that the Hamilton sound recording, I almost said soundtrack.
Yes, you did.
I almost said soundtrack, and then we would have gotten 1,000 emails of angry people.
But you stopped yourself.
I did.
And probably 5,000 who wouldn't know. Yeah, but anyway, come on.
But it is doing really well, and we were saying that we hoped it would have done really well, but it really has topped the charts and done extraordinarily well. Good sales on the Hamilton train that is just never seems like it's stopping.
Speaking of good sales, today there came reports that they have the show itself has an advance sale of, I believe, $57 million.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. However, I have to I have to admit that the 1963, I think, movie, The Manchurian Candidate, has Angela Lansbury and whoever plays her husband, I don't remember, who are going around talking about how there were so many communists in Congress and so on and so forth, and they have no idea how many they should accuse. And he happens to be hitting a Heinz ketchup bottle, which has 57 varieties. And the next day, there are 57 communists in Congress. So I couldn't help thinking there was the press agent for Hamilton, you know, putting ketchup on his steak, which he can afford, and said, you know, let's say it's 57. I'm kidding. I'm sure they have 57 million. In fact, it's harder to believe that they don't have 57 million. Anyway, good luck to them, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who was on 60 Minutes last night, certainly acquitted himself beautifully, showed himself to be a real musical theater fan. His parents turned out to be lovely people, and we see why he turned out to be such a wonderful young man. So, sure. You love it when the people who really deserve it get the success.
Yes, but The Manchurian Candidate is a great movie.
Oh, is it ever?
Has it been turned into a musical? Does it matter if it has not been turned into a musical?
No, John Lartho did a play version that was on Theater Row some years ago. And I have to admit that I didn't think it was nearly as good as the picture. In fact, one scene even struck me out of sequence. I don't remember which one it was. But if you have not seen The Manchurian Candidate, certainly – and I'm not talking about the remake with Meryl Streep and Denzel Washington, though that's a good movie for its own sake too. But the real original Manchurian Candidate with, of all people, Frank Sinatra doing a very good job as an actor.
Very good job.
He was a good actor. Yeah. Lawrence Harvey and again, Angela Lansbury, who got an Oscar nomination, in fact. And this is a few years before she did Mame, when she was still playing those very difficult ladies. And, of course, playing...
Much older than she was.
Exactly. That's my point. I think she was something like 3 or 4 years older than Lawrence Harvey, who was playing her son. So... And by the way, if you look carefully in The Manchurian Candidate, you're going to see the marquee for New Faces of 62 at the Alvin Theater. And you can also see, if you can slow it down in your DVD, you'll see across the street from that at what was then the Amphitheater, the marquee for A Man for All Seasons. So now, if that isn't enough motivation to see the movie, I don't know what is.
So back to Hamilton just for a split second before we wrap up for the evening. I think Hamilton has got an especially, can you say especially unique? I hate when people do something like that.
I'm afraid unique's a unique word.
Unique. Yeah. So you have a unique situation at Hamilton where we can't imagine what's next for Lin-Manuel Miranda because he's in the show. So what will be his next show, the next property that all the Broadway producers are surely trying to take lunches with him to see what else he can put out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And as I may have mentioned, I really loved In the Heights. I think I liked it even more than anyone that I know. I thought it was a wonderful show with a tremendous amount of heart and really great writing. But even having said that, when I first heard about Hamilton, I thought, that doesn't sound like a very good idea. So, so just for whatever that's worth, you never know. You really never know. But I'm so happy that it has been embraced, even though I do think that it's so all about our day and age that it's a little unfortunate that the level of scrutiny and attention is so high that I think that may be turning people off to some extent. Now, it hasn't seemed to hurt the show, so that's the main thing. But I think some people just have a natural reaction to when something is that highly, highly, highly praised that they think, oh, it can't be that good, and oh, you know, I don't need to see that, and sour grapes kind of thing. So,
and the other part of that too is that whenever something becomes a really big hit, inevitably people turn against it simply because it is a big hit.
Right.
Many of us remember when Annie was beloved, and then Annie was not beloved, and many of us even remember when Phantom was beloved, and then it was not beloved.
And Cats. Too much.
Yeah, cats do. Too much success, of course, makes a lot of people turn against you, which I hate, by the way. I hate that. You know, there was a Beach Boys song called Be True to Your School, just like you would to your girl. I say be true to your show, because if you love it when it starts out, you shouldn't dislike it because everybody else gets to know what it is and they like it too. You know, so I hate when that happens. And but it's inevitable, Hamilton, because indeed, you know, that's what success happens. That's what it brings. And that's one of the liabilities. And I remember Frank Rich interviewing Nathan Lane about a month after the Producers Open, his saying, well, the backlash has got to start any day now, you know, and it's true. It just does.
Well, mm-hmm. I completely agree, Peter, but I also think a lot of the backlash is from people who have not seen it, you know, because it's just they feel like excluded and, you're not part of the club. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
So that's the other part of it.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know about you, Michael. I don't know about you, James, but I'm hearing from a lot of old friends. You know?
Oh, yes.
Suddenly, I'll never be lonely again as long as Hamilton is selling tickets. So
yeah. A lot of people are like, hey, you remember we met? And I was wondering if not only do they want house seats, but they want discounted house seats. You know,
yeah, right.
Yeah, like that's gonna happen.
And, you know, and I was like, okay, well, I'll make a phone call, but you know, they're $150 a seat, or face value, whatever the house seat face value is. And they were like, could you get something cheaper? I said, no, it's house seat is a house seat, you know, just so.
I knew a teenager whose parents were getting divorced in the late 80s, and her sister, who I had never spoken to. Never called me up, and I thought, oh, this poor girl, you know, she feels so terrible about, you know, her parents breaking up. I mean, look at this. She's calling me out of the blue, blah, blah, blah. And I was telling her how divorce isn't necessarily such a bad thing. And I mean, for me, it turned out to be a wonderful thing, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm doing about 20 minutes of this. She says, yeah, I know. But can you get me four for Phantom on Saturday night? You know, and that's. So she didn't need my divorce advice.
Oh, so a little housekeeping before we move on. Last week, we did our interviews separately. I interviewed Seth Rudetsky separately from Michael and Peter on a different day, and then we threw it into the recording last week. So we had two different trivia answers, which confused the whole mess. So there were two trivia answers last week. One was from Seth's interview, when I read a quote, and a few people got the right answer that the quote was actually from Lin-Manuel Miranda about Seth Rudetsky. So there's... Peter and Michael might have been confused when a lot of answers came through and said the Lin-Manuel Miranda was the answer to the trivia question, because Lin-Manuel Miranda was not the answer to Peter's trivia question, which was what, Peter?
Yeah, who played Carrie? Who was in City Center Revival played in a musical that she left during tryouts. And the point was, the name of the musical she left during tryouts was the same name of the character that she had played in the City Center Revival. And my hat is off to Jed Slaughter, who was the one who got it, that Barbara Cook played Carrie Pipperidge in a 1954 City Center Revival of Carousel. And then in 1988, she was in Carrie in London and decided not to come with it, and that's why Betty Buckley took over. So that was the answer to that question.
I got it first, but I heard the question before he did. So.
Yes, all right. That's fair. Yes, you did.
All right. Before we ask the next trivia questions, let's remind our listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, what is the next trivia question?
The two words, why brown? With a question mark. it's a sentence, why Brown should show up on an original cast album, but the person making the original cast album decided not to include those two words in the middle of a song. What's the song? What's the show?
If you know the answer to that trivia question, and there's only one trivia question this week, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know next week if you had the right answer. So on behalf of Michael Poitier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. This
here, fancy frillery just...